Who are we going to communicate with? I ask. And Croge says there must be others out there. Then he tells me about the Mad Atoms, how they were working with Zeb, but then the Corpsicorps tracked them down through a Mad Atom codenamed Crake, and they ended up as brain slaves in a place called the Paradise Project Dome. It was a choice between that and being spray-gunned, so they took the jobs. Then when the flood came and the guards vanished, they deactivated the security and walked out. But that wasn't too hard for them because they're all brainiacs. He's told me some of this before, but he hasn't said Paradise Project or Crake. Just a minute, I say. That's what they were working on inside the dome? Immortality? Yes, Croge says. They were all helping Crake with his big experiment. Some kind of perfectly beautiful human gene splice that could live forever. They were the ones who'd done the heavy lifting on the Bliss Plus pill, too. But they weren't allowed to take it themselves. Not that they were tempted. It gave you the best sex ever, but it had serious side effects, such as death. That's how the pandemic plague got started, Croge says. They said Crake ordered them to put it in the super sex pill. I felt lucky all over again that I'd been in the sticky zone, because I might have gulped down the Bliss Plus pill secretly, even though Mortis said no drugs for scalies. It sounded so great, like a whole other reality. Who'd do a thing like that? I say. A poison sex pill? It was Glenn. It must have been. That's the sort of stuff he was telling the rejuve Mr. Biggs at Scales. He didn't tell about the poison part, of course. I remembered those nicknames, Oryx and Crake. I thought it was just sex talk, with Glenn in his main plank. A lot of people used animal names at such times. Panther and Tiger, and Wolverine, Pussycat, and Doggywog. So not sex talk. Code names. Or maybe both. For one split second I think about saying all this to Croge, how I know quite a lot about this Crake from a former life. But then I'd have to tell about what I used to do at Scales, not just the trapeze dancing, or even Glenn making us purr and sing like birds, but the other things, the feather ceiling room things. Croge wouldn't want to hear about that. Guys hate to picture other guys doing sex things with you that they want to do themselves. So instead I ask, what about the splice people, the perfect ones? Did they actually make them? Glenn always wanted everything to be more perfect. Yeah, they made them, says Croge, as if it's an everyday thing making people. I guess those people died along with everyone else, I say. Nope, says Croge. They're living down by the shore. They don't need clothes. They eat leaves. They purr like cats. Not my idea of perfect. He laughs. Perfect is more like you. I let that go by. You're making this up, I say. No, I swear, says Croge. They get these huge... Their dicks turn blue. Then they have group sex with these blue-assed women. It's wicked. It's a joke, right? I say. Seen them myself, says Croge. We aren't supposed to go near them in case we mess them up. But Zeb says we can look at them from a distance like the zoo. He says they're not dangerous. It's us that's dangerous to them. When can I see them? Once we take care of those painballers, says Croge. I'd have to go with you, though. There's another guy down there, sleeps in a tree, talks to himself, crazy as a bag of snakes. No offense to snakes. We leave him alone, figure he might be infected. I wouldn't want him bothering you. Thanks, I say. This Crake in the Paradise Project Dome, what did he look like? Never saw him, says Croge. Nobody said. Did he have a friend? I asked. Inside the dome thing? When Glenn brought Jimmy to Scales that time, they were definitely into something together. Rhino says he wasn't much on friends, but he did have some pal of his in there, plus his girlfriend. The two of them were supposed to be planning the marketing. Rhino says the guy was a waste of time, told a lot of stupid jokes, drank too much. That would be Jimmy, all right, I thought. Did he make it out? I say. Out of the dome? With the blue people? How would I know? Anyway, who gives a shit? Says Croge. I do. I don't want Jimmy to be dead. That's kind of harsh, I say. Hey, be cool, says Croge. He puts his arm around me, lets his hand fall onto my breast as if by accident. I take it off. Okay, he says in a disappointed voice. He kisses my ear. The next thing I know, Croge is waking me up. They're back, he says. He hurries out, and I put my clothes on, and when I go outside, Zeb is there in the yard, and Toby's got her arms around him. Katuro's there, and the man they call Black Rhino, who's even kind of black. Shaggy's there, too, grinning over at me. He hasn't heard yet about the two painballers and Amanda. Croge will have to tell him. If I do, he'll ask me questions, and I only have bad answers. I go slowly over to Zeb. I'm feeling shy, and Toby lets go of him. She's smiling, not a thin smile, a real one, and I think she can still be pretty sometimes.
Little Wren, you grew up, Zeb says to me.
He's grayer than the last time I saw him. He smiles and squeezes my shoulder briefly. I remember him singing in our shower back at the gardener's. I remember the times he was nice to me. I'd like him to be proud of me for making it through, even though that part was mostly luck. I'd like him to be more surprised and happy that I'm alive. But he must have a lot on his mind. Zeb and Shaggy and Black Rhino have spray guns and pack sacks, and now they start opening up the pack sacks and taking things out. Tins of soybeans, a couple of bottles, looks like booze, a handful of Jolt bars, 3 cell packs for the spray guns.
From compounds, Katuro says. Gates open on a lot of them. Looters have been through. Cryogenius was locked up tight, says Zeb. Guess they thought they could tough it out inside. Them and all the frozen heads they had in there, says Shaggy. I doubt anyone got out, says Black Rhino.
I'm sorry to hear that, because Lucerne must have been inside that compound, and despite how she acted later, she was my mother once, and I used to love her. I look over at Zeb, because maybe he did too.
You find Adam One? Says Ivory Bill.
Zeb shakes his head.
We looked in the Buena Vista, Zeb says. They must have been there for some time, them or someone. There were all the signs. Then we tried a few more Ararats, but nothing. They must have moved on.
Did you tell him someone was living in the wellness clinic? I say to Croge, in that little room in behind the vinegar barrels with the laptop.
Yeah, I did, says Croge. It was him and Rebecca and Katuro. We did see that crazy guy limping along and talking to himself, says Shaggy. The one who sleeps in a tree down by the shore. He didn't see us, though.
You didn't shoot him? Says Ivory Bill. In case he's catching?
Why waste the ammo? Says Black Rhino. He won't last long.
When the sun's low, we make a fire outside in the yard and have nettle soup with chunks of meat in it, I'm not sure what kind, and burdock, and some mohair milk cheese. I'm expecting them to begin the meal with, "Dear friends, we are the only people left on Earth. Let us give thanks," or some gardener thing like that. But they don't. We just have the dinner. After we've finished, they talk about what to do next. Zeb says they have to find Adam One and the gardeners before anything or anyone else gets to them. He'll go to the sinkhole tomorrow to check out the Edencliff rooftop and some of the truffle safe houses and other places they might have gone. Shaggy says he'll go with him, and Black Rhino and Katuro say the same. The others need to stay and defend the cob house against the dogs and pigs
and also the two painballers in case they come back. Then Ivory Bill tells Zeb about Toby and how Blanco's dead now. And Zeb looks at Toby and says,
"Well done, babe."
It's kind of shocking to hear Toby called a babe, sort of like calling God a stud muffin. I work up my courage and say we need to find Amanda and get her away from the painballers. Shaggy says he'll vote for that, and I think he means it. Zeb says he's very sorry, but we have to understand that it's an either-or choice. Amanda's just one person, and Adam One and the Gardeners are many, and if it was Amanda, she'd decide the same thing. Then I say, "Okay, I'll go alone then." And Zeb says,
"Don't be silly," as if I'm still 11.
Then Croge says he'll go with me, and I squeeze his hand for thank you. But Zeb says he's needed at the Cobb House. They can't do without him. If I wait until he and Shaggy and Rhino and Katuro get back, he says, they'll send three guys with me, with spray guns, which will give us a much better chance. But I say there isn't enough time, because if those painballers want to trade Amanda, it means they're tired of her, and they could kill her at any minute. I know how it works, I say. It's like scales with the temporaries. She's a disposable. So I really have to find her right now, and I know it's dangerous, but I don't care. Then I start crying. Nobody says anything. Then Toby says she'll go with me. She'll take her own rifle. She's not a bad shot, she says. Maybe the painballers have used up their last spray gun cell, which would lengthen the odds. Zeb says,
"That's not such a good idea."
Toby pauses, then says it's the best idea she can come up with, because she can't let me wander off into the woods by myself. It would be like murder. And Zeb nods and says,
"Be very careful."
So it's settled. The Mad Adams hang up some duct tape hammocks in the main room for Toby and me. Toby's still talking with Zeb and the rest of them, so I go to bed first. With a mohair rug, the hammock's quite comfortable, and though I'm worrying a lot about how to find Amanda and what will happen then, I finally manage to sleep. When we get up the next morning, Zeb and Shaggy and Katuro and Black Rhino have already left, but Rebecca tells Toby that Zeb's drawn a map for her in the sand of the old kid's sandbox, with the Cobb House and the shore marked on it, so she'll know the directions. Toby studies it for a long time with an odd expression on her face, a sad kind of smile, but maybe she's just memorizing it. Then she wipes it away. After breakfast, Rebecca gives us some dried meat, and Ivory Bill gets two lighter hammocks for us because it's not safe to sleep on the ground, and we refill our water bottles from the well they've dug. Toby leaves a bunch of stuff behind, her bottles of poppy, her mushrooms, her maggot container, all the medical stuff. But she takes her cooking pot and her knife and the matches and some rope because we don't know how long we'll be gone. Rebecca hugs her and says, "Watch your back, sweetheart." And then we set out. We walk and walk. At noon, we stop to eat. Toby's listening all the time. Too many bird calls of the wrong kind, such as crows, or else no bird calls at all, means look out, she says. But all we're hearing is background cheeping and chirping. "Bird wallpaper," says Toby. We keep walking and eat again and walk some more. There are so many leaves. They steal the air. Also, they make me nervous because of the last time we walked in a forest and found oats hanging. When it gets dark, we choose some big enough trees and string up the hammocks and climb in. But it's hard for me to sleep. Then I hear singing. It's beautiful, but it's not like normal singing. It's clear, like glass, but with layers. It's like bells. The singing fades away, and I think maybe I was imagining things, and then I think it must have been the blue people. That must be how they sing. I picture Amanda among them. They're feeding her, taking care of her, purring to heal her and comfort her. It's make-believe. Wishful thinking, I know I shouldn't do it. I should face reality. But reality has too much darkness in it, too many crows. The Adams and the Eves used to say, "We are what we eat." But I prefer to say, "We are what we wish." Because if you can't wish, why bother?
St. Terry and All Wayfarers. Year 25. Of the Wandering State, spoken by Adam 1.
Dear friends, dear fellow creatures, fellow sojourners on this dangerous road that is now our pathway through life, how long it has been since our last St. Terry's Day on our beloved Eden Cliff rooftop garden. We did not realize then how much better those times were compared with the dark days we are living through now. Then we enjoyed the prospect from our peaceful garden, and though that prospect was one of slums and crime, yet we viewed it from a space of restoration and renewal, flourishing with innocent plants and industrious bees. We raised our voices in song, sure that we would prevail, for our aims were worthy and our methods without malice. So we believed in our innocence. Many woeful things have happened since, but the spirit that moved us then is present still. St. Terry's Day is dedicated to all wayfarers, prime among them St. Terry Fox, who ran so far with one mortal and one metallic leg, who set a shining example of courage in the face of overwhelming odds, who showed what the human body can do in the way of locomotion without fossil fuels, who raced against mortality, and in the end outran his own death and lives on in memory. On this day we remember, too, St. Sojourner Truth, guide of escaping slaves 2 centuries ago, who walked so many miles with only the stars to guide her, and Saints Shackleton and Crozier of Antarctic and Arctic fame, and St. Lawrence Titus Oates, of the Scott expedition, who hiked where no man had ever hiked before and who sacrificed himself during a blizzard for the welfare of his companions. Let his immortal last words be an inspiration to us on our journey. I am just going outside, and maybe some time. The saints of this day are all wayfarers. They knew so well that it is better to journey than to arrive, as long as we journey in firm faith and for selfless ends. Let us hold that thought in our hearts, my friends and fellow voyagers. It is fitting that we remember those whom we have lost so far on our journey. Darren and Quill have succumbed to an illness, the early symptoms of which are cause for grave apprehension. At their own request, we have left them behind us. We thank them for showing such praiseworthy concern for those of us who remain healthy. Philo has entered a fallow state and is at peace on top of a parking garage, a location that reminds him, perhaps, of our own dear rooftop. We should not have allowed Melissa to lag so far behind us. Via the conduit of a wild dog pack, she has now made the ultimate gift to her fellow creatures and has become part of God's great dance of proteins. Put light around her in your hearts. Let us sing The Longest Mile.
The last mile is the longest mile. 'Tis then we weaken. We lose the strength to run. out hope's beacon. Shall we turn back from this dark road, foot sore and weary, when deep despair has drained our faith and all seems dreary? The last mile is the longest, longest mile. The last mile is the longest, longest mile. Shall we give up the narrow path, the parting byway, swift transport and false delight, destruction's highway? Shall enemies erase our life, our message bury, and shall they quench in war and strife the torch we carry? The last mile is the longest, longest mile. The last mile is the longest, longest mile. Take heart, O dusty travelers, though falter, though you be felled along the way, you'll reach the altar, for in the effort is the goal. 'Tis thus we're treasured, He knows us by our pilgrim soul. 'Tis thus we're measured. The last mile is the longest, longest mile. The last mile is the longest, longest mile. The last
Chapter 74. Wren, St. Terry and All Wayfarers. Year 25. When I wake up, Toby's already sitting in her hammock, doing some arm stretches. She smiles at me. She's smiling more lately. Maybe she does it now to encourage me. "What day is today?" she says. I think for a moment. "St. Terry, St. Sojourner," I say. "All wayfarers." Toby nods. "We should do a short meditation," she says. "The path our feet will travel on today will be a dangerous one. We'll need inner peace." When any of the Adams or the Eves tells you to do a meditation, you don't say no. Toby climbs out of her hammock, and I stand watch in case of surprises while she goes into the lotus. She's quite flexible for someone her age. But when it's my turn, although I bend myself into the shape just like rubber, I can't do the meditation properly. I can't manage the first three parts, the apology, the gratitude, the forgiveness, and especially not the forgiveness, because I don't know who I need to forgive. Adam 1 would say I'm too fearful and angry. So I think about Amanda and everything she did for me and how I never did anything for her. Instead, I allowed myself to feel jealous of her about Jimmy, though Jimmy was in no way her fault, which wasn't fair. I have to find her and get her away from whatever may be happening to her.
though maybe she's already hanging in a tree with parts of her cut out like oats. But I don't want to picture that, so instead I imagine myself walking towards her, because that's what I'll have to do. It is not only the body that travels, Adam One used to say, it is also the soul. And the end of one journey is the beginning of another. I'm ready now, I say to Toby. We eat some of the dried mohair meat and drink some water and cache the hammocks under a bush so we won't have to carry them. We should take the pack sacks, though, says Toby, with the food and stuff. Then we look around to make sure we haven't left any obvious traces of ourselves. Toby checks the rifle. I'll only need 2 bullets, she says. If you don't miss, I say, 1 for each painballer. I picture the bullets moving through the air, straight into, what? An eye? A heart? It makes me flinch. I can't afford to miss, she says. They've got a spray gun. Then we rejoin the pathway and continue on in the direction of the sea, towards where I heard the voices coming from in the night. After a while, we hear those voices, but they aren't singing, just talking. There's the smell of smoke, a wood fire, and children laughing. It's Glenn's made-on-purpose people. It has to be. Walk slowly, she says in a low voice. The same rules as for animals. Stay very calm. If we have to leave, back away. Don't turn and run. I don't know what I'm expecting, but it isn't what I see. There's a clearing, and in the clearing there's a fire, and around the fire there are people, maybe 30 of them. They're all different colors, black, brown, yellow, and white, but not one of them is old, and not one of them has any clothes on. A nudist camp, I think, but that's only a joke I make to myself. They're too good-looking, way too perfect. They look like ads for the Anu U spas, bimplants and totally waxed, no body hair at all, resurfaced, airbrushed. Sometimes you can't believe in a thing until you actually see it, and these people are like that. I didn't quite believe that Glenn had really done it. I didn't believe what Croge told me, even though he'd actually seen these people. But now, here they are, right in front of me. It's like seeing unicorns. I want to hear them purr. When they spot us, first one of the children, then a woman, then all of them, they stop whatever they're doing and turn to stare at us, all together. They don't look frightened or threatening. They look interested, but placid. It's like being stared at by the mohairs, and they're chewing like the mohairs as well. Whatever they're eating is green. A couple of the kids are amazed enough by us that they keep their mouths open. Hello, says Toby. To me, she says, stay here. She steps forward. One of the men stands up. He's been squatting beside the fire, and moves out in front of the rest. Greetings, he says. Are you a friend of Snowman? I can hear Toby pondering her choices. Who is Snowman? If she answers yes, will they think she's an enemy? What if she answers no? Is Snowman good? Says Toby. Yes, the man says. He's taller than the others and seems to be their spokesman. Snowman is very good. He is our friend. The rest nod, still chewing. Then we are his friends too, says Toby. And we are your friends as well. You are like him, says the man. You have an extra skin, like his, but you have no feathers. Do you live in a tree? Feathers, says Toby. On his extra skin.
No, on his face, says the man. Another came, like Snowman, with feathers, and one with him who had short feathers, and a woman who smelled blue but did not act blue. Perhaps the woman with you is like that? Toby nods as if she understands all of this. Maybe she does. I can't ever tell exactly what she understands.
She smells blue, says another man. That woman with you.
All the men are now sniffing in my direction as if I'm a flower or maybe a cheese. A number of them have sprouted huge blue erections. Croge warned me about this, but I've never seen anything like it, even at Scales, where some of the clients went in for body paint and extenders. Several of these men are giving out a strange humming sound, like the kind you make by rubbing your finger around the rim of a crystal glass. But the other woman that came was frightened when we sang to her and offered her flowers and signaled to her with our penises, says the chief one.
Yes, the two men were frightened also. They ran away.
How tall was she? Says Toby.
The woman. Taller than this one?
She points to me.
Yes, taller. She was not well. Also, she was sad. We would have purred over her and made her better. Then we could have mated with her.
It must be Amanda, I think. So she's still alive. They haven't killed her yet. Hurry up, I want to shout. But Toby's not going anywhere yet.
We wished her to choose which four of us she would copulate with, says the main one. Perhaps the woman with you will choose. She smells very blue.
At this, the men all smile. They have brilliantly white teeth, and their penises point at me and wag from side to side like the tails of happy dogs.
Four? All at once?
I don't want Toby to shoot any of these men. They seem so gentle, and they're very good-looking. But also, I don't want those bright blue penises anywhere near me.
My friend isn't really blue, says Toby. It's just her extra skin. It was given to her by a blue person. That's why she smells blue.
Where did they go? These two men and the woman?
They went along the shore, says the main one. And then, this morning, Snowman went to find them.
We could look under her extra skin and see how blue she is.
Snowman has a hurt foot. We purred over it, but it needs more purring.
If Snowman was here, he would find out about the blue. He would tell us how we should act.
Blue should not be wasted. It is a gift from Crake.
We wanted to go with him, but he told us to stay here.
Snowman knows, says one of the women. So far, the women have been taking no part in the conversation, but now they all nod and smile.
We must go now and help Snowman, says Toby. He is our friend.
We will come with you, says another man, a shorter one, yellow in tone, with green eyes. We will help Snowman, too.
Now that I notice, they all have green eyes. They smell like citrus fruits.
Snowman often needs our help, says the tall man. His smell is weak. It has no power, and this time he is sick. He is sick in his foot. He is limping.
If Snowman told you to stay here, you must stay here, says Toby.
They look at one another. Something's worrying them.
We will stay here, says the tall man, but you must come back soon.
And bring Snowman, says one of the women, so we can help him. Then he can live in his tree again.
And give him a fish. A fish makes him happy.
He eats it,
says one of the children, making a face. He chews it up. He swallows it. Craik says he has to.
Craik lives in the sky. He loves us, says a short woman. They seem to think this Craik is God.
Glenn as God, in a black t-shirt. That's pretty funny, considering what he was really like. But I don't laugh.
We could give you a fish, too, says the woman. Would you like a fish?
Yes, bring snowman, says the tall man. Then we will catch 2 fish, 3, 1 for you, 1 for snowman, 1 for the woman who smells blue.
We'll do our best, says Toby.
This seems to puzzle them. What is best? Says the man. We step out from under the trees, into the open sunlight and the sound of the waves, and walk over the soft, dry sand, down to the hard, wet strip above the water's edge. The water slides up, then falls back with a gentle hiss, like a big snake breathing. Bright junk litters the shore, shards of plastic, empty cans, broken glass. I thought they were going to jump me, I say.
They smelled you, says Toby. They smelled the estrogen. They thought you were in season. They only mate when they turn blue. It's like baboons.
How do you know all that? I say. Croge told me about the blue penises, but not about the estrogen.
From Ivory Bill, says Toby. The Mad Atoms helped to design that feature. It was supposed to make life simpler, facilitate mate selection, eliminate romantic pain.
Now we should keep very quiet.
Romantic pain, I think. I wonder what Toby knows about that.
There's a line of deserted high-rises standing in the offshore water. I remember them from our gardener trips to the Heritage Park beach. It was dry land out there before the sea levels rose so much, and all the hurricanes. We'd learned that in school. Gulls are soaring and settling on the flat roofs. We can get eggs there, I think, and fish. Jacklight, Zeb taught us, if you're desperate. Make a torch, the fish will swim to the light. There's a few crab holes in the sand. Small ones. Nettles growing farther up the beach. You can eat seaweed, too. All those St. Yule things. I'm wishing again, planning lunch, when in the back of my head is just plain fear. We can never do it. We'll never get Amanda back. We'll be killed. Toby's found some tracks in the wet sand. Several people with shoes or boots, and the place where they took the shoes off, maybe to wash their feet, and then where they put the shoes back on and headed up towards the trees. They could be in among those trees right now, looking out. They could be watching us. They could be aiming. On top of those tracks is another set, barefoot.
Someone limping, whispers Toby, and I think, it must be Snowman, the crazy man who lives in a tree.
We slip our pack sacks off and leave them where the sand ends and the grass and weeds begin, under the first trees. Toby says we don't need them weighing us down. We need our arms free.
Chapter 75. Toby, St. Terry and all wayfarers. Year 25. So God, thinks Toby. What's your view? Supposing you exist. Tell me now, please, because this may be the end of it. Once we tangle with the painballers, we don't have a cat's chance in a bonfire the way I see it. Are the new people your idea of an improved model? Is this what the first Adam was supposed to be? Will they replace us? Or do you intend to shrug your shoulders and carry on with the present human race? If so, You've chosen some odd marbles. A clutch of one-time scientists, a handful of renegade gardeners, two psychotics on the loose with a nearly dead woman. It's hardly the survival of the fittest, except for Zeb. But even Zeb's tired. Then there's Wren. Couldn't you have picked someone less fragile, less innocent, a little tougher? If she were an animal, what would she be? Mouse? Thrush? Deer in the headlights? She'll fall apart at the crucial moment. I should have left her back there on the beach. But that would prolong the inevitable, because if I go down, so will she. Even if she runs, it's too far back to the Cobb house, she'll never make it. And if she outruns them, she'll get lost. And who's going to protect her from the dogs and pigs in the wild woods? Not the blue folks back there. Not if the paintballers have a spray gun that works. Much worse for her if she doesn't die immediately. The human moral keyboard is limited, Adam One used to say. There's nothing you can play on it that hasn't been played before. And, my dear friends, I am sorry to say this, but it has its lower notes. She stops, checks the rifle. Safety off. Left foot, right foot, quietly along. The faint sounds of her feet on the fallen leaves hit her ears like shouts. How visible, how audible I am, she thinks. Everything in the forest is watching. They're waiting for blood. They can smell it. They can hear it running through my veins. Katush. Above her head, clustering in the treetops, the crows are treacherous.
Ha, ha, ha.
They want her eyes, those crows. Yet each flower, each twig, each pebble shines as though illuminated from within, as once before on her first day in the garden. It's the stress. It's the adrenaline. It's a chemical effect. She knows this well enough. But why is it built in, she thinks. Why are we designed to see the world as supremely beautiful, just as we're about to be snuffed? Do rabbits feel the same as the fox teeth bite down on their necks? Is it mercy? She pauses, turns, smiles at Wren. Do I look reassuring, she wonders, calm and in control? Do I look as if I know what the hell I'm doing? I'm not up to this. I'm not fast enough. I'm too old. I'm rusty. I don't have the whiplash reflexes. I'm weighted down with scruples. Forgive me, Wren. I'm leading you to your doom. I pray that if I miss, we both die quickly. No bees to save us this time. What saint should I call upon? Who has the resolution and the skill, the ruthlessness, the judgment, the accuracy? Dear leopard, dear wolf, dear Liobam, lend me your spirits now.
Chapter 76. Wren, St. Terry and all wayfarers. Year 25. As soon as we hear voices, we go forward, very silently. Heel on the ground, said Toby. Then roll forward on the foot. Other heel on the ground. That way nothing dry snaps. The voices are men. We can smell the smoke from their fire, and another smell, charred meat. I realize how hungry I am. I can feel myself drooling. I try to think about this hunger instead of being scared. We peer through the leaves. It's them, all right. The one with the longer dark beard, the one with the light stubbly beard, and the shaved head that's growing in. I remember everything about them, and I feel like throwing up. It's hate and fear grabbing at my stomach and sending tendrils through my whole body. But now I see Amanda, and I feel so light all of a sudden, as if I could fly. Her hands are free, but there's a rope around her neck with the other end tied to the leg of the dark-bearded guy. She's still wearing her khaki desert girl outfit, though it's filthier than ever. Her face is smudged with dirt. Her hair is dull and stringy. She has a purple bruise under one eye, and there are other bruises on the bare parts of her arms. She still has some of the orange nail polish on her fingers from scales. Seeing it makes me want to cry. She's only skin and bones, but the two of them don't look so fat themselves. I feel myself breathing fast. Toby takes hold of my arm and gives it a squeeze. That means keep calm. She turns her brown face towards me and smiles a shrunken head smile. The edges of her teeth glint through her lips, the muscles of her jaws tighten, and all of a sudden, I feel sorry for those two men. Then she lets go of my arm and lifts the rifle very slowly. The two men are sitting cross-legged, broiling chunks of meat on sticks over the coals. Rackhunk meat. The black and white striped tail is on the ground over to the side. There's a spray gun on the ground, too. Toby must have seen it. I can hear her thinking, if I shoot one of them, will I have time to shoot the other one before he can shoot me?
Maybe it's some fucking savages thing, the dark-bearded one is saying. Blue paint.
Nah, tattoos, says the short hair.
Who'd get their dick tattooed? Says the bearded one.
Savages will tattoo anything, says the other. It's some cannibal thing.
You've been watching too many dumb movies. Bet they'd human sacrifice her in about 2 minutes, says the bearded one. After they all had sex with her.
They look over at Amanda, but she's staring at the ground. The bearded one jerks the rope.
We're talking to you, bitch, he says.
Amanda raises her head.
A sex toy you can eat, says the short hair, and the two of them laugh. You see the bimplants on those bitches, though?
Not bimplants, they were real. Way to find out? Cut them open. The fake ones have got, like, some kind of gel in them. Maybe we could go back there, do a trade, says the bearded one. With the savages, they get this one. They seem to want her so much, stick their blue dicks into her, and we get some of those hot babes of theirs. Fucking good deal.
I see Amanda as they see her, used up, worn out, worthless.
Why trade? Says the short hair. Why not just go back and shoot the fuckers?
Not enough juice in this thing to shoot all of them. Cell pack's really low. They'd figure that out. They'd rush us, tear us apart, and eat us.
We gotta get farther away, says the short hair, alarmed now. 30 of them, 2 of us. What if they sneak up on us in the dark?
There's a pause while they think about this. My skin is crawling all over. I hate them so much. I wonder why Toby's waiting. Why doesn't she just kill them? Then I think, she's old Gardner. She can't do it. Not in cold blood. It's against her religion.
Not too bad,
says the bearded one, lifting a skewer from the coals.
We can bag another one of these tasty little suckers tomorrow.
We gonna feed her?
Says the short hair. He's licking his fingers.
Give her some of yours, says the bearded one. She's no use to us dead.
No use to me dead, says the short hair. You're such a pervert, you'd plank a fucking corpse.
Speaking of which, your turn first. Get the pump primed. I hate a dry fuck.
It was me first yesterday.
So, we arm wrestle?
Then suddenly, there's a fourth person in the clearing. A naked man, but not one of the green-eyed beautiful ones. This one is emaciated and scabby. He has a long, scraggly beard, and he looks very crazy. But I know him. Or I think I know him. Is it Jimmy? He's carrying a spray gun, and he has it aimed at the two men. He's going to shoot them. He has that kind of maniac focus. But he'll shoot Amanda, too, because the dark-bearded guy sees him and scrambles up onto his knees and pulls Amanda in front of him, one arm around her neck. The short hair ducks in behind them. Jimmy hesitates, but he doesn't lower the spray gun.
"Jimmy!" I scream from inside the shrubbery. "Don't! That's Amanda!"
He must think the bushes are talking to him. His face turns. I come out from behind the leaves.
"Great! The other bimbo," says the bearded one. "Now we'll have one each."
He's grinning. The short hair crouches forward, reaches for their spray gun. Toby steps into the clearing. She has the rifle up and aimed.
"Don't touch that," she says to the short hair.
Her voice is strong and clear, but dead flat even. She must sound scary to him, and look it, too. Skinny, tattered, teeth bared, like a TV banshee, like a walking skeleton, like someone with nothing to lose. The short hair freezes. The one holding Amanda doesn't know which way to turn. Jimmy's in front of him, but Toby's off to the side.
"Back off! I'll break her neck," he says to all of us.
His voice is very loud. That means he's afraid.
"I might care about that, but he doesn't," Toby says, meaning Jimmy.
To me, "Get that spray gun. Don't let him grab you." To the short hair,
"Lie down."
To me, "Watch your ankles." To the bearded one,
"Let go of her."
This is very fast, but at the same time, slowed down. The voices are coming from far away. The sun so bright it hurts me. The light crackles on our faces. We glare and sparkle as if electricity's running all over us like water. I can almost see into the bodies, everyone's bodies, the veins, the tendons, the blood flowing. I can hear their hearts like thunder coming nearer. I think I might faint, but I can't because I need to help Toby. I don't know how, but I run over, so close I can smell them. Rancid sweat, oily hair, snatch up their spray gun.
"Around behind him," Toby tells me.
To the paintballer,
"Hands behind your head."
To me,
"Shoot him in the back if you don't see those hands, quick."
She's talking as if I know how to work this thing. To Jimmy, she says,
"Easy now."
As if he's a big frightened animal. All this time Amanda has kept still, but when the dark bearded one lets go of her, she moves like a snake. She pulls the rope noose up and over her head and whips the guy across the face with it. Then she kicks him in the nuts. I can tell she doesn't have a lot of strength left, but she uses all she has, and when he doubles over on the ground, she kicks the other one. Then she grabs a stone and whacks each of them over the head, and there's blood. Then she drops the stone and hobbles over to me. She's crying, big gulping sobs, and I know it must have been very terrible those days when I wasn't there, because it takes more than a lot to make Amanda cry.
"Oh, Amanda," I say to her, "I'm so sorry."
Jimmy's swaying on his feet.
"Are you real?"
he says to Toby. He looks so bewildered. He rubs his eyes.
"As real as you," says Toby. "You'd better tie them up," she says to me. "Do a good job. When they come out of it, they're going to be very angry."
Amanda wipes her face on her sleeve. Then we start knotting the two of them together, the hands behind the backs, a loop around each neck. We could use more rope, but it will do for now.
"Is it you?" says Jimmy. "I think I've seen you before."
I walk towards him slowly and carefully because he still has his gun.
"Jimmy," I say, "it's Ren. Remember me? You can put that down. It's okay now.
It's how you'd say it to a child. He lowers the spray gun, and I wrap my arms around him and give him a long hug. He's shivering, but his skin's burning hot.
Ren, he says, are you dead?
No, Jimmy. I'm alive, and so are you. I smooth back his hair.
I'm such a mess, he says. Sometimes I think everyone's dead.
St. Julian and All Souls. Year 25. Of the Fragility of the Universe. Spoken by Adam One.
My dear friends, those few that now remain, only a little time is left to us. We have used some of that time to make our way up here to the site of our once flourishing Eden Cliff rooftop garden, where in a more hopeful era we spent such happy days together. Let us take this opportunity to dwell for one final moment on the light. For the new moon is rising, signaling the beginning of St. Julian and All Souls. All Souls is not restricted to human souls. Among us, it encompasses the souls of all living creatures that have passed through life and have undergone the great transformation and have entered that state sometimes called death, but more rightly known as renewed life. For in this our world and in the eye of God, not a single atom that has ever existed is truly lost. Dear Diplodocus, dear Pterosaur, dear Trilobite, dear Mastodon, dear Dodo, dear Great Auk, dear Passenger Pigeon, dear Panda, dear Whooping Crane, and all you countless others who have played in this our shared garden in your day, be with us at this time of trial and strengthen our resolve. Like you, we have enjoyed the air and the sunlight and the moonlight on the water. Like you, we have heard the call of the seasons and have answered them. Like you, we have replenished the earth. And like you, we must now witness the end of our species and pass from earthly view. As always on this day, the words of St. Julian of Norwich, that compassionate 14th century saint, remind us of the fragility of our cosmos, a fragility affirmed anew by the physicists of the 20th century, when science discovered the vast spaces of emptiness that lie not only within the atoms, but between the stars. What is our cosmos but a snowflake? What is it but a piece of lace? As our dear St. Julian so beautifully said in words of tenderness that have echoed down through the centuries, he showed me a little thing, the quantity of a hazelnut lying in the palm of my hand, as round as any ball. I looked at it and thought, what may this be? And I was answered generally thus, it is all that is made. I marveled how it might last, for I thought it might fall suddenly to nothing, for little cause. And I was answered in my understanding, it lasts and ever shall, for God loves it. And so has everything its being through the love of God. Do we deserve this love by which God maintains our cosmos? Do we deserve it as a species? We have taken the world given to us and carelessly destroyed its fabric and its creatures. Other religions have taught that this world is to be rolled up like a scroll and burnt to nothingness, and that a new heaven and a new earth will then appear. But why would God give us another earth when we have mistreated this one so badly? No, my friends, it is not this earth that is to be demolished. It is the human species. Perhaps God will create another, more compassionate race to take our place. For the waterless flood has swept over us, not as a vast hurricane, not as a barrage of comets, not as a cloud of poisonous gases. No, as we suspected for so long, it is a plague. A plague that infects no species but our own, and that will leave all other creatures untouched. Our cities are darkened. Our lines of communication are no more. The blight and ruin of our garden is now mirrored by the blight and ruin that have emptied the streets below. We need not fear discovery now. Our old enemies cannot pursue us, occupied as they must be by the hideous torments of their own bodily dissolution, if they are not already dead. We should not, indeed we cannot, rejoice at that. For yesterday the plague took three of us. Already I sense within myself those changes that I see reflected in your own eyes. We know only too well what awaits us. But let our going out be brave and joyous. Let us end with a prayer for all souls. Among these are the souls of those who have persecuted us, those who have murdered God's creatures and extinguished His species, those who have tortured in the name of law, who have worshipped nothing but riches, and who, to gain wealth and worldly power, have inflicted pain and death. Let us forgive the killers of the elephant and the exterminators of the tiger and those who slaughtered the bear for its gallbladder and the shark for its cartilage and the rhinoceros for its horn. May we forgive them freely as we may hope to be forgiven by God who holds our frail cosmos in His hand and keeps it safe through His endless love. This forgiveness is the hardest task we shall ever be called upon to perform. Give us the strength for it. I would like us all to join hands now. Let us sing, "The Earth Forgives."
The earth forgives the miner's blast that rends her crust and burns her skin. The centuries bring trees again and water and fish therein. The deer at length forgives the wolf that tears his throat and drinks his blood. His bones return to soil and feed the trees that flower and fruit and seed. And underneath those shady trees, the wolf will spend a restful day. And then the wolf in turn will turn to grass the dew will graze. All creatures know that some must die, that all the rest may take and eat. Sooner or later, all transform their blood to wine, their flesh to meat. But man alone seeks vengefulness and writes his abstract laws on stone. For this false justice he has made, he tortures limb and crushes bone. Is this the image of a god? My tooth for yours, your eye for mine. If revenge did move the stars instead of love, they would not shine. We dangle by a flimsy thread,
Our little lives are grains of sand. The cosmos is a tiny sphere held in the hollow of God's hand. Give up your anger and your spite and imitate the deer, the tree. In sweet forgiveness find your joy, for it alone can set you free. It alone can set you free. Sweet, sweet forgiveness can set you free.
Chapter 77. Wren, St. Julian and All Souls. Year 25. The new moon's rising now, out over the sea. St. Julian and All Souls has begun. I loved St. Julian's when I was little. Each of us kids would make our own cosmos out of stuff we'd gleaned. Then we'd stick glittery things onto it and hang it on a string. The feast that night was round foods like radishes and pumpkins, and the whole garden would be decorated with our shining worlds. One year, we made the cosmos balls out of wire and put candle ends inside them. That was really pretty. Another year, we tried to make divine hands for holding the cosmos balls, but the yellow plastic housework gloves we came up with looked very strange, like zombie hands. Anyway, you don't picture God as wearing gloves. We're sitting around the fire, Toby and Amanda and me and Jimmy and the two gold team paintballers. I have to include them. The light flickers on all of us and makes us look softer and more beautiful than we really are. But sometimes it makes us darker and scarier too, when the faces go into shadow and you can't see the eyes, only the eye sockets. Deep pools of blackness welling out of our heads. My body hurts all over, but at the same time I feel so joyful. We're lucky, I think, to be here, all of us, even the painballers. After the midday heat and the thunderstorm, I went back to the beach for our pack sacks and brought them to the clearing, along with some wild mustard greens I'd found along the way. Toby took out her cooking pot and the cups and her knife and her big spoon. Then she made soup with the leftovers from the rackhunk and the rest of Rebecca's meat, some of her dried botanicals. When she put the bones of the rackhunk into the water, she spoke the words of apology and asked for its pardon. "But you didn't kill it," I said to her. "I know," she said. "But I wouldn't feel right unless somebody did this." The painballers are tied to a nearby tree with the rope and also some braided strips torn from Toby's once pink top to toe. I did the braiding. If there's one thing the gardeners taught you, it was craft uses for recycled materials. The painballers aren't saying much. They can't be feeling great, not after being pounded by Amanda. They must also be feeling stupid. I would be if I were them. Dumb as a box of hair, as Zeb would say, for letting us creep up on them like that. Amanda must be still in shock. She's crying gently off and on, and twisting the raggedy ends of her hair. The first thing Toby did, once the painballers were safely roped up, was to give her a cup of warm water with honey for dehydration, with some of her lamb's quarters powder stirred in. "Don't drink it all at once," she said. "Just little sips." Once Amanda's electrolyte levels were back up, said Toby, she could start to deal with whatever else about Amanda needed fixing. The cuts and bruises to begin with. Jimmy's in bad shape. He has a high fever and a festering sore on his foot. Toby says that if only we can get him back to the Cobb house, she can use maggots. Those might work in the long run. But Jimmy may not have the long run. Earlier, she spread some honey on his foot and fed him a spoonful of it as well. She can't give him any willow or poppy because she left those back at the Cobb house. We wrapped him up in Toby's top to toe, but he keeps unwrapping himself. We need to find him a bedsheet or something, Toby says, for tomorrow, and figure some way of keeping it on him or he'll broil to death in the sun. Jimmy doesn't recognize me at all, or Amanda either. He keeps talking to some other woman who appears to be standing by the fire.
Owl music. Don't fly away, he says to her.
There's such longing in his voice. I feel jealous, but how can I be jealous of some woman who isn't there?
Who are you talking to? I ask him.
There's an owl, he says. Calling, right up there.
But I don't hear any owl.
Look at me, Jimmy, I say.
The music's built in, he says. No matter what.
He's gazing up into the trees.
Oh, Jimmy, I think. Where have you gone?
The moon's moved westward. Toby says the bone soup has boiled enough. She adds the mustard greens I collected, waits a minute, then ladles out. We've got only 2 cups. We'll have to take turns, she says.
Not them too, says Amanda.
She won't look at the painballers.
Yes, says Toby. Them too. This is St. Julian and All Souls.
What happens to them, says Amanda, tomorrow?
At least she's taking an interest in something.
You can't just let them loose, I say. They'll kill us. They murdered Oates, and look what they did to Amanda.
I'll consider that problem, says Toby, later. Tonight is a feast night.
She dips the soup into the cups, then looks around the firelight circle.
Some feast, she says in her dry witch voice. She laughs a little. But we're not finished yet.
Are we?
She says this last thing to Amanda.
Kaput,
says Amanda. Her voice is so small.
Don't think about it, I say.
But she begins to cry again, softly. She's in a fallow state. I put my arms around her.
I'm here, you're here. It's okay, I whisper. What is the point?
Says Amanda. Not to me, but to Toby. This is not the time, says Toby in her old Eve voice, for dwelling on ultimate purposes. I would like us all to forget the past, the worst parts of it. Let us be grateful for this food that has been given to us. Amanda, Wren, Jimmy, you too if you can manage it. This to the 2 painballers. One of them mutters something like, fuck off, but he doesn't say it very loudly. He wants some of the soup. Toby continues on as if she hasn't heard. And I would like us to remember those who are gone, throughout the world, but most especially, our absent friends. Dear Adams, dear Eves, dear fellow mammals and fellow creatures, all those now in spirit, keep us in your view and lend us your strength, because we are surely going to need it. Then she takes a sip from the cup and passes it to Amanda. The other cup she gives to Jimmy, but he can't hold it right and he spills half of the soup into the sand. I crouch down beside him to help him drink.
Maybe he's dying, I think. Maybe in the morning he'll be dead.
I knew you'd come back, he says, this time to me. I knew it. Don't turn into an owl.
I'm not an owl, I say. You're out of your mind. I'm Wren. Remember? I just want you to know that you broke my heart. But anyway, I'm happy you're still alive. Now that I've said it, something heavy and smothering lifts away from me, and I truly do feel happy. He smiles at me, or at whoever he thinks I am, a blistery little grin.
Here we go again, he says to his sick foot. Listen to the music.
He tilts his head to the side. His expression is rapturous.
You can't kill the music, he says. You can't.
What music? I say, because I don't hear anything.
Quiet, says Toby.
We listen. Jimmy's right. There is music. It's faint and far away, but moving closer. It's the sound of many people singing. Now we can see the flickering of their torches, winding towards us through the darkness of the trees.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. This program was directed by Janet Stark, executive producers Orly Moskowitz and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by O.W. Toad Limited. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. Hymn lyrics by Margaret Atwood from The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. Original music composed and sung by Orville Stober. Copyright 2009 by Earthly Arc Music. www.earthlyarc.com. All rights reserved.